The final topic of the think tank discussion was management of stage 3 disease, and Dr. Harvey Pass reviewed an RTOG SWOG trial he co-chairs comparing cisplatin and docetaxel chemotherapy alone or with radiation treatment prior to surgical resection of stage 3A disease, followed in both arms by docetaxel maintenance. Dr. Chris increased the room temperature considerably in the room by challenging the value of this study. But to begin, Dr. Choi provided his thoughts on the trial.
This kind of study will hopefully change the practice pattern, because if you sample oncologists in the big meetings, they ask the question whether they give pre-op chemotherapy or chemoradiation stage 3A, even a split, half and half.
Here we are.
Institution, right. Even here.
You all, same thing
even
here.
So, we need to answer the question. We need to standardize how we're going to do pre-op chemo or chemoradiation, and this is a study will answer the question. This is probably last time we have this kind of trial.
Marty? I think the intergroup data is really important, and this is an area where I think the subgroup stuff says a lot about the practice of surgery, as we discussed before, of who's doing these procedures. I think that if you have people who are not qualified to operate in the chest after chemo radiation, you have a bad outcome. I think surgery is good, but you better have a good surgeon, and that's one of the important things. And so, Harvey, this trial requires boarded thoracic surgeons, people who actually know what they're doing. Because, our mortality from pneumonectomy is a tenth of this, including right pneumonectomy, and we've analyzed the data. It's just not a big deal if you've got the right people.
Actually, why aren't pneumonectomies excluded from
exactly.
this based on the previous
right.
study?
They sort of overlap. The data from Kathy Albane came out, and this was already going. But that is a problem.
That's never stopped an amendment.
That's a big problem.
All the time.
Harvey, can you respond to that?
I think it's very difficult to predict a patient that is going to require a pneumonectomy based on the preoperative studies. I don't think we're smart enough as surgeons or as radiologists to say that. And I agree with you about the concern about the right pneumonectomies. But also, the data with regard to these sort of morbidities of a 24% for right or whatever it was in this trial simply does not bear out at other institutions.
Yeah, we've looked at it.
And I don't know why.
Mayo's looked at it.
And, at the Anderson, the problem is, Roy, is that in looking at your data from your surgeons, there aren't a lot of pneumonectomies in the series that talked about this. And apparently, in a reanalysis of some of the data from Sloan, the original mortalities are not as high as what it was thought.
I have to tell you, I'm not a big fan of this trial, and I don't see what the question is. Hock says it might change practice, but when all's said and done, just like with the Albane trial, the results are going to be the same.
What specifically don't you like about the study?
The results are being the same.
Well, if they're the
There's
same,
no question.
Then if they're the same, no RT.
No.
Wait
a minute.
People will
Wait
still do what they want
the
to do.
The results being the same means a lot of people are going to be in heaven. And we've spent the day here so far trying to decide some ways of trying to get people to live longer, and we're designing a trial that is not going to help anybody live a nanosecond longer.
Harvey?
I appreciate Mark's passion for this. But I must admit that I think that we were very sensitive to this issue. And I think that on a gross basis, we thought that patients were put into Kathy's trial that probably should not have been put into Kathy's trial with regard to surgical expectations. We have tried in this trial specifically to put the brakes on the type of bulky disease that was defined in the other trial. And I think you would agree that a lobectomy in this situation is different than a pneumonectomy.
Yes.
So in good faith, we've tried to define the trial in a way that we try to answer a question and also change the population that we're looking at. Whether that's going to actually happen, I don't know. But the way we've tried also to do this is to be very careful as to who gets put into the trial. And number two, with regard to the surgical issues, we've done something very controversial also. I have, in that I mandated that you could not have surgeons in this trial who were not board-certified thoracic surgeons. And also, the pre-site questionnaire comes out of a questionnaire that came out of Marty and Mark Krasna's study with high-dose radiation therapy, in which I specifically look at the number of cases at each center have done induction chemotherapy trials and how many pneumonectomies or lumpectomies they've had in that particular situation before I sign my name on the dotted line that allows those surgeons to go into this trial. So we are very sensitive to that. We've tried to modify it. to help the patients and try to decrease the toxicity.
I want to ask, before you comment, could you just tell me, Mark, what question would you like to see addressed in this patient population, or how could this study be modified that would make you happy?
That we compare groups of patients, one of whom is receiving intervention that has some literature-based expectation it will improve survival, and that does not exist for adding radiation to chemo for induction.
So what would you like to see studied in this patient population?
Induction or LOTI in people that don't smoke.
Rogerio?
You know, I think Harvey's comments are well taken, but they're also a little bit of a double-edged sword. Because what happens is you select your patients more carefully, you select your surgery, select your surgeon, and then let's say you get a positive trial. When that gets translated into the community, you're going to see people with bulkier disease being offered the same strategy. You're going to see surgeons that are not the quality of surgeons that operated on the trial doing the same thing. So it's a little bit risky. You wonder about the applicability of these data to and to patients.
If I can address, I think that's a good point. The assumption of, let's just say, being cavalier after the study is done. But this study is going to take at least, in my opinion, 4 to 5 years to get done. Now, at the same time, we discussed issues before about how can we mandate that surgery can be safer in these patients in the community. Well, at the same time, the surgeons who are teaching people at the centers that do this sort of stuff in the academic community needs to be able to train the surgeons that can recognize the limits so that that's the generation that's going to go out and not everybody doing this type of stuff. So I think that in a parallel course, we have to be emphasizing that this is selective surgery, this is certain high-risk surgery, and that only certain individuals that really are familiar with it should be doing it.
So have you made it too selective? Because the trial in the first year, you know, it's a known fact, the accrual is very poor. So it asks the question, here's a, I think, a reasonable question, but you know, somewhat mundane, but it's hard to do anything with the targeted therapies yet because of the complexity of this area. So a very specific trial is designed with all these correlative studies and this and that, and then there are more study chairs than there are patients on the trial after the first year. So well, what does that say? What are we going to do?
I think that you're right about the accrual. I think that the only way I can answer that is that over the last month and a half, when we went from one patient to 8 patients, in which we went back to RTOG and central headquarters and said, how many centers are really up and running and ready to go here? And so it was very delayed as to how many could go on. And when it reached a period of about 70 that were actually fully, and it took a year to get all these institutes on and completed.
I just want to ask Alan, where are we in terms of BEV in this patient population in terms of clinical trials?
There are some pilot studies that are looking at it. The issue, of course, is in the neoadjuvant setting with the bevacizumab and its potential effects on wound healing is how do you do it? And then some of the investigators have been quite creative, Mark, of course, being one of them, giving 3 cycles of chemotherapy, the bevacizumab with the first 2, so you have a washout, so to speak, period of about 6 to 8 weeks before going on to surgery. And so that you have some small pilot studies. One comment related to that is my bias with this study is I sort of agree with Mark. I said it at the time. I think we rushed to do a phase 3 study when there wasn't a phase 3 question personally worth answering. I thought you had a negative study. I thought surgery was out of the question.
Mark, just to get back to something you said about this not being the most incredibly compelling question, I think this is still a question that for 15 years we've danced around. And I think what it's done is this question has bottlenecked and prevented us from introducing novel agents into stage 3 disease. I personally would love to get out from the burden of having to give chemo radiotherapy before surgery. And right now, when I get into arguments with my radiotherapists, they point out that the best data still is with chemo radiotherapy followed by surgery. Tough to argue with that until we have
data.
Show
me the data.
Yeah, what data is that?
The best phase 2 data.
Let's have our radiation therapist.
Heck.
So I disagree with what Mark says about adding radiation pre-op improves survival over chemotherapy. So go back to the intergroup Cassie study. The median survival for those patients got surgery, but 26 months, chemo RT followed by surgery. For those patients underwent lobectomy, 36 months. Show me any data giving chemo alone, stage 3 disease, showing median survival 26 months. There isn't.
But those people didn't have surgery. That's a different question.
Mark?
You see, my issue, we have 2 phase 3 trials that address the role of surgery. One, the intergroup trial, the other, the ORTC trial. They're both negative. So then the question comes up with this subset analysis based upon lobectomy and pneumonectomy. And although you try to match and make sure the patients are saying, you cannot match for the most important prognostic factor, which is downstaging. So you don't know that lobectomy may look better just because they happen to have all the downstage patients. Right. So I think the important questions out of this trial is that, and I've been a big proponent that this is clearly a negative trial, and outside of a clinical trial, the standard is chemo-RADS. What I would like to see is, how do you identify the downstage patients? And in those downstage patients who have persistent disease in a lobe, does surgery, if you resect that lobe, does that improve their survival? I think that this question of chemo versus chemo-RADS, I agree with Mark Crisp, it's a boring question to me. I'm interested in improving the cure rate. So it's those patients who have persistent disease in a lobe that a surgeon can take out with low morbidity and mortality.
Are you saying in a lobe, or how do you distinguish that from in a lobe as opposed to residual mediastinal disease? Because we have better ways of...
Well, no. I'm saying that what I would like to see is a trial that gave patients induction, reassess their mediastinum. If their mediastinum is negative, then reassess the lobe. And then in the lobe, we can talk about how to do that, but you could use PET or whatever. We don't know. We'd have to figure that out. But does surgery, which is really a local regional treatment, because we know local regional therapies can improve survival, but does surgery added to the other local regional treatment, radiotherapy, add in that population? I think that's the important question.
I think it's a good question because, frankly, all these patients are being operated on, so we will know clinical correlates of PET and what happens with it as far as the lymph node basins. But in my heart of hearts, I'm a believer that patients who are going to benefit from this the most are the patients that are going to absolutely have nodal sterilization. And then your question asks the correlate of, okay, we really haven't concentrated on residual sterilization of the tumor. I mean, how does that impact? Because it's a no-go if you biopsy the lymph nodes and the residual. So I think it's a very reasonable question. Certainly, that trial design is extraordinarily interesting. I can't comment on it because that's not the trial design that we have here.
I want to spend some time on non-protocol management. We can maybe come back to this. Tom, for the people that are out there driving in their car or in their garden or working out, can you review what this question is and what the results were?
So this question's a very good question and one that I think a bit surprised that 8 people agreed with this. But this is the idea of about whether or not you should operate on somebody who's got a positive MEAD after induction therapy. I voted clearly with the disagree group. I have yet to understand how people have so clearly endorsed this idea that you shouldn't be operating on people because they only have a 10 or 15% cure rate. That's all anybody has with this disease is a 10 or 15% cure rate. I just don't understand this idea. Of course, the cure rate's less if you have a positive MEAD than it is if you have a negative MEAD, but it's not zero. So I just don't understand why we've given up surgery in that group.
So you voted, you agree or disagree?
I disagree. This person should get surgery.
Well, I totally disagree with that. I think if there are two messages from 0139. One is, if the patient needs a pneumonectomy, especially on the right side, after chemo and radiation, don't do it. Number two, if you don't sterilize or convert the mediastinal nodes, this is probably not beneficial in the long term. You know, it's for those patients who converted that the N0 patients after induction chemo and radiation, that the survival was, 45, 50%, 3 or something to that effect. This is someone who goes through induction, still has a positive mediastinum, and should have surgery?
Well, see, the question, though, Tom, is
no.
In the equation,
yes.
I would give them local regional therapy. I would give them radiotherapy. We don't know what they got, but I'm not sure that in that patient who has persistent N2 disease after induction therapy, we don't know whether it was chemo alone, is that surgery is going to be better than aggressive chemo RADS.
That's the worst way to manage it, because what happens there is you have that 4-week break in between the end of your chemo RADS.
That's the problem.
Not for a MEAD. You do the MEAD
on they get chemo radiotherapy. Right. They wait 3 or 4 weeks, get their MEAD.
Uh-huh.
Okay, and then you've had this 3-week break, and you've only given them 50 gray, and you're not going to cure anybody with 50 gray and a 4-week break.
Salvage options, you know, for patients like this. But surgery is not the answer.
Let's ask the radiation
oncologist. Comment based on what Mark says or what Tom says. Again, when do you assess mediastinoscopy? When do you assess down pathologic staging? Typically 3 to 4 weeks after finishing chemo radiation, it's not enough time to fully understand pathological downstaging.
So how did
you
vote on this?
So you cannot say, based on mediastinoscopy, whether go or no go surgery. You do know at the beginning whether the patient should be operable or not. Okay, you have to make a decision up front. You cannot assess.
I agree with that.
Our surgeons never do repeat meets. Yeah. I mean, we decide beforehand, correct, are you or are you not doing right surgery? And if you are going to do it, we do the 5-6 weeks of chemo, radiation, whatever, go on to surgery, end of story. If we're not going to do surgery, it's 6-7 weeks of the chemo RT, and it's no, well, you know, maybe we can, no.
The only reason to do a mediastinoscopy after induction therapy is to make a decision, are you going to do surgery or not? Right?
We make that decision beforehand.
No, I agree.
So
with that.
You don't reassess the mediastinum after the induction.
No, you can't. It doesn't give you the data.
It's also pretty difficult.
I think the problem with this is chemo radiotherapy varies a lot. So at our place, we give them a definitive. They get 61.6 gray of radiation preoperatively with concurrent chemotherapy. We reassess their mediastinum. If the mediastinum is positive, at least based on our current thinking, and we'll admit we've had a lot of debate about this and things may yet change, but at the moment, what we would do is if they're still positive, they go on and receive further chemotherapy. Some of those patients will do quite well long-term. Most of them will end up relapsing, but it can be 2 years later. If their mediastinum is clear, we will then resect, and then they get further adjuvant chemotherapy in that setting. A fair number of those patients have gotten complete path CRs. Others will still have some residual disease in a lobe and probably are cured as a result of this. And then, of course, I'd have no idea. There may be 5 tumor cells hanging out in some of the people that were, quote, path CRs. So I think that this is evolving. Now, we are actually testing this concept of restaging after high-dose chemo radiotherapy in the RTOG. And we have passed, shall we say, our first cut point in this phase 2 trial, which has demonstrated substantial mediastinal sterilization, 2 to 3 times that reported previously in patients using the high-dose chemo radiation. I think this is a good surrogate for those who are likely to benefit from a thoracotomy. I mean, a thoracotomy is a big deal. So I think that there is a value to this reassessment. The other question is, and I think which is not answered in our big debate, is say you get your chemo radiotherapy, you still have a contaminated mediastinum but no distal disease. We give them further chemotherapy, and we've seen some of those patients, like I said, live for 2-3 years before a relapse. Should we have resected those patients then after that full dose chemotherapy? And I don't know the answer to that question.
I mean, I think Tom's concern is if you wait to reassess, what you said is 3 weeks or 4 weeks, and then you choose not to proceed with surgery, so you end up with suboptimal radiation.
Absolutely.
You know, and compromising. But I'm not sure that this means that you should operate on people. You end up with suboptimal treatment, but I'm not sure that doing surgery is the optimal strategy either. I don't know.
I think we're in a moving target right now because I think we've got two issues, timing as well as reassessment of the mediastinum. And we don't have answers for either at this point. But what is coming and what we want is a non-invasive way of assessing the mediastinum that has excellent specificity and sensitivity. That's non-invasive. It's a moving target because that technology is starting in the United States and is going to be endobronchial ultrasound. I am convinced that we are going to be able to answer questions about residual mediastinal disease in a fairer way that will be an outpatient procedure, much less invasive, and also much more sensitive and specific, but we're not ready for that yet. That will then satisfy Tom's idea that we need to know what the residual disease is at a given time point and then make the decision without having to wait 3 weeks or whatever. Now, the other way to get rid of the 3 weeks is to do the Edelman-Maryland approach, which is just give more radiation therapy, and apparently that is turning into a greater mediastinal sterilization rate, and then do your endobronchial ultrasound to really make it a decision of go, no go. And I think that therefore we have competing and parallel studies that have not converged yet to say what the optimal minimally invasive and timing issues are. So that's the problem with designing new trials.
I'd like to ask Hack, we talked before about quality control in terms of surgery and variation, community, et cetera. What about radiation therapy, particularly in locally advanced disease?
This is a huge problem as much as surgery. The technique and dose varies from institutions. Now, what Mott is commanding is based on really the experience of the University of Maryland and based on phase 2 day study ongoing RTOG. It looks interesting, promising, encouraging to see high-dose radiation appears to give a higher downstaging of stage 3A patients, but I think we still have to wait another year or two.
But what do we know about quality control in radiation oncology in the community as relates to this situation? Marty's saying it depends who your radiation oncologist
is. That's a good question.
Is that the case?
It is a problem. It is a problem in the community level. The radiation varies, tremendously varies.
Is it really? I mean, because
yes, it is.
The people in the community, the radiation oncologists in the community have all the bells and whistles and
it's
hardware.
A very
they don't?
Thin field.
One of our colleagues, as she went to another institution, was appalled to learn that they still had cobalt machinery.
Let's say we do a patient education program for lung cancer patients. Do we advise them to go to a tertiary care center to get the radiation
yes.
therapy?
Yes.
I would advise that they at least go there for an opinion and that they talk to the radiation oncologist and then whoever they refer them to, they go over the planning with them. There are some very good community sites, but that's something that the tertiary center, the multimodality approach, clearly benefits the patient.
How can either a patient or a referring doc decide whether or not the radiation oncologist is sort of up to speed, both hardware and in terms of treatment plans?
That's going to be difficult to assess from patients and also difficult to assess from your referring physician's point of view. You're really going to have to get a second opinion from the major institution who done the work. The radiation oncotherapy is like a surgery. It's a local regional treatment. So having better tool, better equipment, it's like getting a better knife. But who drives behind the knife, behind the machine, is going to be important to get better therapy. And that really varies from institution to institution. That's the problem.
Ed?
And just to echo what Tack and Roy just said, and that's exactly what I tell the patients, is that you should hear an opinion from our docs. If you ask them, is the therapy I'm getting in my respective city or township as good as what I could get here, you ask that to the radiation doc, they will look at you either with a look of skepticism or a look of reassurance, and that's sort of what they can decide. I tell the patient, if they would be fine going down the street to get their heart bypass, then do the same thing with radiation. But if you're going to go to one of the major centers to get your heart bypassed, then that's the way you have to think of your radiation.
Mark?
They need to ask the radiation oncologist, what is the V20 going to be? How much esophagus is in the field initially? How much is it going to decrease? All these sorts of things, because the toxicity is clearly increased with combined modality, and it will be increased if you have poorer quality radiation and you have a lot of normal tissue receiving an excessive dose. So I think we need to think about that. And we actually had a very interesting experience in CLGB where we had to close our trial with gemcitabine in a combined modality setting. And when we looked back at the dose volume histograms, these patients, if they got radiotherapy by themselves without gemcitabine, probably would have had significant toxicity. We blame the gemcitabine, but we forget that it's an interplay between the radiotherapy and the gemcitabine.
One of the most popular chemo radiation regimens for locally advanced non-small cell is the so-called 9504 SWOG regimen of cisplatin etoposide radiation followed by docetaxel maintenance, and toxicity data on this regimen were reported at ASCO by the Hoosier Oncology Group, as commented on by Dr. West.
SWOG had a phase 2 trial, 9504, that I'll show briefly. Very promising, although with the caveat that it's a phase 2 trial with 83 evaluable patients with pathologically staged 3B disease with cis and etoposide administered along with radiation therapy concurrently to 61 gray, and then followed that with docetaxel, initially ambitiously treating 75 per meter squared every 3 weeks, to potentially be escalated to 100 milligrams per meter squared, which was not feasible. The reason that there was so much interest in this was that the survival appeared to be so much better than historical controls would have dictated, with the 3-year survival of 37%, but more importantly, even with longer follow-up, being held up at 29% long-term survival. However, there are questions about a small trial, significant proportion of the patients having T4N0 disease, and just how representative this was of a larger experience. That was partly tested with the SWOG-0023 approach, where everyone received the same cisplatin etoposide and RT concurrent to 61 gray, and everyone received up to 3 cycles of consolidation docetaxel. If you got through all of that, you would then be randomized to a maintenance strategy of gefitinib or placebo. In the accrued patients, as well as the subset of eligibles, it's a minority, somewhere in the range of 40 to 45%, who can get through
the entire program up to the point of maintenance. So really, this issue of it being challenging to get through that whole program with three cycles of consolidation docetaxel has been present since Karen Kelly presented it at ASCO last year. There was certainly some reason to still be enthusiastic about the consolidation approach. While the median survival for the overall group is not 26 months as in the phase 2 experience, it was still quite encouraging compared to historical data at 19 months, with a very significant proportion of the patients still early on the survival curve and a very real possibility that this may improve over time. Also, the fact is that the experimental arm of maintenance gefitinib appeared to be potentially quite detrimental, although not statistically significantly so. Certainly, when you looked at the patients who were on placebo compared to gefitinib, these patients did remarkably well in absolute terms, although certainly limiting to the group that have already gotten to that stage. But 19-month overall survival, median overall survival, taking all comers despite the potentially detrimental effect of gefitinib. Now, that obviously did not isolate the variable of consolidation docetaxel. Everyone got it, even though Swaggart initially proposed this kind of idea, and it was disallowed by CTEP as not an important enough question. The Hoosier Oncology Group took up the baton to ask the most direct question of whether consolidation docetaxel really added to the other alternate of observation alone after definitive chemoradiotherapy without any consolidation. And this trial has been ongoing for a few years now, and safety data were presented at ASCO with 241 patients accrued, and they found two-thirds of patients were able to be randomized after the definitive chemoradiation to the question of consolidation docetaxel or observation. What they really highlighted were the challenges of administering treatment safely and feasibly, that for the patients who were randomized, 76 in total, only 29% of patients were able to get through three complete cycles, and it was a pretty even drop-off, almost a third before then. The 22% required dose reductions along the way, and a third of patients required growth factor support, and 5% required red blood cell transfusions. Now, that would be, I think, quite appropriate consideration and justified if the survival holds up as truly beneficial. We don't have those data yet. The Hoosier Oncology Group presentation really highlighted the toxicity challenges. 20% of the patients randomized to consolidation being hospitalized, a total of 21 times, 15 patients, a third of patients with febrile neutropenia, 19% with infections without neutropenia, and then 9.5% pneumonitis rate, and four treatment-related deaths accounting for 5.5% of that group of patients. That can be put into context of the preceding trial experience in SWOG, and you could see that, in truth, it's not very different, that SWOG has seen a 7% grade 3 or higher pneumonitis rate, and the treatment-related death rate has been in the range of 5% in the preceding trials as well. So, again, we're left with more of a highlighting of the toxicity challenges here than efficacy, but really not out of keeping with what we've seen before. SWOG's current focus is on integrating bevacizumab as safely as possible into this general treatment strategy, with the hypothesis that radiation to the primary tumor will reduce the risk of hemorrhage, and we'll be incorporating it at increasingly early stages in this program and try to define the timing and safety profile. The primary objective of SWOG's about-to-get-started trial, 0533, will be evaluation of toxicity, particularly grade 4 and 5 hemorrhage issues, and we're going to be separating patients into a higher risk and a lower risk population. Secondary endpoints are going to be looking at survival and response rate and also exploration of molecular correlate studies. 0533, low risk stratum, is going to have non-squamous histology or mixed with less than 50% squam, no cavitary lesions and not close to a major vessel, and no history of hemoptysis, whereas the high-risk stratum will have any one of these, either a higher proportion of squamous, a tumor of any histology with cavitation, or close to a major vessel, or any history of hemoptysis. No brain metastases, adequate bone marrow, and no anticoagulation, and none of the anticoagulants or history of coagulopathy problems. The schema is basically that we are going to be working backward from incorporating bevacizumab into the consolidation strategy to incorporating it earlier on. So there are going to be three cohorts with each of the two strata. The first cohort, getting bevacizumab only with the consolidation after a complete course of chemoradiotherapy. The second cohort will get it integrated at day 15 of the chemoradiotherapy program, so at least after 2 full weeks, to potentially reduce that risk of bleeding. And then the last cohort will receive Avastin in combination with chemoradiotherapy really from the very beginning of the treatment program, provided that appears to be feasible and safe from the preceding experience. Toxicity monitoring obviously has to be very careful. It's going to be a weekly assessment with a rapid reporting system for hemorrhage-specific adverse events and a designated CRA at each site with weekly emails for communication. So overall conclusions, the chemoradiotherapy followed by consolidation docetaxel approach has certainly looked very encouraging in the preceding SWOG experience, but has not isolated the variable of the consolidation docetaxel yet in the phase 3 setting. It's fair to say that it's been challenging before and it remains challenging that the Hoosier Oncology Group trial really just brings that to light more emphatically. We see a 5% treatment-related death rate in all of these trials, and the question is whether that could really be reduced significantly by adding prophylactic growth factor support, potentially by reducing the dose of consolidation docetaxel, at least in a subset of patients, hasn't been answered. Despite the toxicity issues, if it actually is shown in the Hoosier Oncology Group trial that survival is markedly superior in the recipients of the docetaxel, it will probably be worth it in the end of the day, but we don't have those data yet. And SWOG's going to be as carefully as possible integrating bevacizumab into this treatment approach, really with an almost real-time model to modify the plans if it looks like we're getting worrisome toxicity issues, particularly hemorrhage.
Thanks, Jack. And for our final discussion, I'd like to hear about your thoughts about the non-protocol approach to these patients, what you think about this study. First, I'll ask you, Roger, do you use the 9504 regimen off study?
Yes.
And do you use growth factors?
Yes, to both questions.
Okay. Maybe you can elaborate on your points.
So the first question was, what do people in this room believe will be the outcome of the HOG trial as far as consolidation versus no consolidation? And then the second question is what Jack just discussed, which is, you know, how do you look at 0023 vis-a-vis 9504 with a median survival of 19 months, but yet a possible detriment for those who received gefitinib? So would the curve be different had gefitinib not been used, for example? I just want to get a sense of how these two trials compare.
Can you answer your own questions first?
Yes. I think the HOG trial is probably not sufficiently powered to detect a statistically significant difference.
If it were powered sufficiently, what do you think it would show?
I think it would show a positive result.
Ed, how do you approach these patients in a non-protocol setting?
I like using the SWOG regimen, the 9504. I agree, sometimes it's difficult to get in the consolidation therapy, and it's mostly because it just varies on how much the concurrent chemoradiation is tolerated by the patient. One of the questions I had, and I don't know if, Hack, if you know any of this, is that when is it safe to give myeloid growth factors around the setting of radiation? We're a little hesitant during radiation, but should you wait 6 weeks, or do you wait 10 weeks, or is it okay to start it after the radiation machine is turned off?
I think there's a lot of the hesitance because of the old Paul Bunn study giving GCSM small cell lung cancer chemoradiation showing significant pneumonitis. That's the only data we have at this point. So a lot of people are reluctant to give it
but
with the radiation.
But that's about to change.
about to change. Right, I've got to come to that point. So we're looking to give chemo radiation. I think you can give it radiation therapy, just not a data. So we're going to do this. Roger is going to have a study in RTOG for small cell lung cancer with chemo radiation with the G-CSF followed by Neulasta.
Yeah. See, what we did, Ed, is we took the 9504 regimen and we added growth factors during the chemo radiation, which has never been done since the Bund study, which is almost 15 years old
and
now.
The Bund was GM.
It was GM and it was in small
right.
cell.
I think that's excellent.
And for the first 10 patients, we've had really no major complications. So we felt that it was reasonable to bring this question to a large phase 2 trial because I think it may change the way we do chemo and radiation, really.
So there's a pilot study, you know, to look at the toxicity, yeah. feasibility.
Tom?
I think one thing just to add that I've become aware of off protocol is I also like it. I also like using the 9504 regimen with the idea of the induction etoposide platinum and then docetaxel consolidation. However, what I've become very acutely aware of is that this concept of radiation field size probably does matter a lot. And this appreciation of V20 and what volume of lung gets more than 20 gray of radiation and limiting that to under 35 or 30% probably has as much to do with bad outcomes than anything else we do. And I think that's something that medical oncologists don't appreciate as much as radiation oncologists do.
And I'll follow that up with doing head and neck cancer. It's not just everybody gets platinum. It depends on what the radiation oncologist is going to treat in that field of head and neck cancer, whether it's going to be IMRT, whether it's a wide field, and that right. will dictate what type of sensitizer I'll use with the radiation.
This concludes our program. Special thanks to our speakers, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for this special Think Tank edition of Lung Cancer Update.